Watcher, everyone. It's a funny word, let alone to start a podcast with. But basically, it just means hello, and it's an informal British slang. I first heard this word in a British TV series called Luther, which is a crime slash psychological thriller. And what gravitated me towards Luther was the introductory music by Massive Attack called Paradise Circus. This song had this underlining ominous feel to it, which was very befitting of the nature of the show. And given that I had only watched about 5 minutes into the show, this song had such a profound effect on how I perceived this entire series before I even completed watching the first episode. And that got me thinking, how could you find a music that is so apt for such a series? And that even before watching the first episode of the series, the music pretty much set the tone in my head of what's to come. So keeping that in mind, welcome to another episode of Be Nudged by Maya. My name is Arjun, and today we're going to talk about two things that piques my interest to no bounds: music and understanding human behavior. So the late neurologist, naturalist, and historian of science, Oliver Sacks, noted in his book Musicophilia that music is a deep, mysterious paradox, for while emotive, music makes one experience pain and grief more intensely. It also brings solace and concentration at the same time. This is because the perception of music depends on our memory. Though music is perceived in the moment, it only makes sense when the individual sonic events are compared to the previous events held in our memory. Memory then is the key to understanding music. It joins the events together into patterns and pattern into a seamless whole, which then becomes music. So then, what we need to do now is to understand how we understand and comprehend music. So in fact, both our working memory, that is the short-term and long-term memory, are used to understand music. The working memory is used to process incoming information and is actually limited to a few seconds in a time and approximately 4 items of information. But in the purview of music and memory, the long-term memory is where the discussion centers around. This is because this type of memory develops in processing and it leaves traces that may last minutes or years. Like verbal information, music can be recalled or recognized. And when I say recognition, I mean the feeling of familiarity when encountering a previously heard music. Most people can recognize a well-known song within a fraction of a second, or name of a song after a few keynotes. I mean, does this happen to you? You're going about your day and suddenly a tune gets stuck in your head. It's repeating over and over again. Well, that phenomenon is actually called an earworm. And this is because recall is generally a more difficult task than recognition. You might recognize that the familiarity in the tune, but it might take you a while to recall the song's name or the first place that you actually heard. Given that we've just spoken about how the mind understands and comprehends music, I decided to take things further and understand if there was a theory at play. Anything to explain why our mind associates one aspect or one concept to another. And it turns out that theory is actually called association theory. And this theory stems from behaviorism. It states that the concepts are learned by simple, reinforced connections between a stimulus and a desired response. Therefore, whenever a person thinks about a concept, the person will also think about the related aspects. The strength of correlation between these thoughts vary based on times, triggers, and availability. For example, when people make connections between a stimulus, example like hearing a bell ring, and a response, it could be like picking up a phone or remembering it's time to wake up because it's your alarm that's ringing, they're actually making an association. And that is the fundamental theory on how we understand and comprehend music. Now, since we understand the human mind perceives music, it is worth understanding why music affects us. So when you are listening to music, your brain lights up like a Christmas tree. Now, if I had an MRI machine I could prove this to you. But for now, since I don't, you would pretty much have to take my word for it. But this wasn't always the case. You know, traditional thinking, going back 25 years ago, dictated that language was always comprehended on the left side of the brain and music was comprehended on the right. But thanks to modern, higher quality neuroimaging systems, we know now that is really not the case. In fact, music is perceived in all parts of the brain, starting with the auditory cortex, which tracks the loudness, tempo, pitch, and rhythm. Then there's the visual cortex activation when you are reading musical notes or watching a musical video. And there's motor cortex activation when you're dancing or tapping your feet. There's the cerebellum, which activates emotional response. There's the hippocampus, which is the memory bank, and that activates when you listen to a familiar sound or a passage in a song. I guess what I'm really trying to say is that music activates all corners of your brain. The response, therefore, is literally visceral. In fact, what's really interesting to analyze is what happens to your mind when you study music. And a lot of research has been done in this field, but this particular research that I'm about to quote showed that studying music over a period of 5 years has improved decision-making, cognitive skills, improved social behavior, and caused a change in the overall brain structure of these students. And these students had a stronger relationship between the right and left hemispheres of their brains, making them really creative problem solvers. But I reckon the biggest effect of music is emotion. For example, when you listen to a slow, heavy ballad or jazz music or just any old song, some people develop goosebumps or like a tingling sensation. Scientifically speaking, that feeling that causes your hair to stand up is called frisson. In fact, music at this point is building a pathway that connects the auditory and emotional region, and this tract or pathway is thicker or stronger for people who get the chills. I mean, think back to our earlier discussion about dissociation theory. This is practically that. As a matter of fact, different kinds of music, loudness and tempo, all have an effect on us because our prefrontal cortex, the more rational side of our brain, kicks in and triggers the brain's internal opioid system. So what's really happening is that when you listen to songs that you're familiar with, there is an increase in dopamine levels. And this chemical helps you feel good, relieve pain, and conversely, if you listen to something that you don't like, the cortisol level increases, and that causes stress, anxiety, and agitation. This is precisely why music is used as a therapeutic mechanism to manage mental stress, to boost memory, and even to eliminate pain. Music can also help in relieving the pain associated with chronic conditions, including dementia, stroke, Parkinson's disease, and multiple sclerosis. In fact, there's a wonderful story about a ballet dancer who, through the power of music, was able to heal herself and dance once again. So, having discussed how we understand, comprehend, and feel when we listen to music, let us now observe the role in music and culture, behavioral economics, and finally, advertising. Now, whilst this makes for really good conversation, my knowledge of music is actually limited to hip-hop, because I practically grew up listening to it. And besides, I think, and this might be a personal projection here, but hip-hop's role in culture is profound. So, history has it, during the 1950s and 60s, many white middle-class people left the cities to move into suburbs. The African Americans and the Latino Americans were left behind in cities, who really moved into the cities during the intervening years. These communities encountered many challenges in the neighborhood as the budgets were slashed and the resources were diverted to the wealthier and whiter communities. Faced with a lack of economic opportunity, as well as rising crime and poverty rates, young people in the Bronx and the nearby communities began creating their own kind of cultural expressions. These forms of expressions would then later come together to form the four pillars of hip-hop. But in the purview of this discussion, I shall limit myself to two of the four pillars of hip-hop culture, which are emceeing and DJing. The other two pillars are graffiti and breakdancing. And starting with DJs, or disc jockey, were people who were manipulating the sounds coming out of turntables to create music. These DJs would create these innovative breaks and isolate the percussive beat by stripping off the vocals from old records. And this signature is what gave hip-hop its initial rise and its iconic sound. In fact, this new form of DJing was actually pioneered by a Jamaican expat in New York City called DJ Kool Herc back in the 1970s. And back in those days, the migration of the West Indian and Hispanic communities into New York City had created block parties that celebrated their own cultural identities, which of course led to the celebration of new music and the creation of new sounds. At the time, DJs were the stars, and later rappers such as Curtis Blow and Grandmaster Flash, with the ingenious rhymes, gained the prominence in the spotlight. But hip-hop culture always started with the DJs. So my introduction into the world of DJing is largely thanks to my childhood friend, DJ Brendan Lopez, back in Dubai. And for as long as I've known him, and he's always been experimenting with music. I mean, I literally watched this guy go from spinning paper plates on our makeshift block parties that we passionately termed gangster parties to actual platters and DJing in all sort of events. But here's the funny bit. For as long as I've known him, I never really asked him what gravitated him towards music. So guess what? I finally did ask him, and this was his answer.
Well, what gravitated me towards music in the first place was actually my upbringing. Like in my house when I was small, there was always music being played, and we used to have like these small house parties with all the family and all. And my brother and my father, like, you know, they used to do this thing where they would record music off the FM from our audio cassette player, things like that. And, you know, I mean, I used to always listen to the music that they used to play at that time. There was always music around. So I would say from a small age itself, my connection to music was there, like, very strongly. As I was growing up, you know, I sort of realized that, you know, the songs that I listened to, my friends didn't listen to. And, you know, the trend that time was very pop, let's say all the way about like 7th or 8th standard, which is maybe 2003, 2004. When suddenly hip-hop became such a big thing, you know. It's like, remember when we were back in Karama, everything was like K-Town gangster, so that gangster vibe and, you know, people dressing up in those clothes and Supra shoes and all was a big thing. So, yeah, I mean, it started off very pop and, you know, getting all these off the top 40 of the radio numbers and then sort of moved into hip-hop. And yeah, that's kind of where it started, you know, like, you know, just started liking collecting music. And people used to always come to me and be like, oh shit, man, where do you get that song from? And I'm like, yo, I just listened to it. And, you know, I sort of knew at that point where I had a good enough collection of music that people like to listen to. And I would say, yeah, that's kind of where the love for music started.
So as you just heard, in the case of Brendan, his love for music is a part of his Anglo-Indian culture, and his household constantly playing different kinds of music, his dad going as far as recording songs from the FM. Similarly, in my household, from the time I woke up till the time I slept, there was always music playing in the background. So the fundamental thing is that we grew up listening to hip-hop, and it had profound effect on us, from the way we spoke, the way we dressed. Hip-hop was so much more than just a genre of music for us. And over the years, I have made friends over my liking towards hip-hop and rappers alone. And I'm not alone in this. And in fact, here's what Brendan had to say about it.
Oh, yes, for sure, man. Hip-hop had quite a big effect on me, even from the days of our gangster parties where we used to gamble with playing cards, and the winning prize was 1 dirham, and the guy had to go down to the grocery and buy Pepsi or some chips and stuff. And I think that was mainly because, like, you know, at that time in school, like I just said, the hip-hop culture was kind of the in thing at that time. wearing baggy clothes and, you know, these cool shoes and those big spinner chains, the spinner necklaces, and listening to music was such a huge thing. And, you know, I remember like every Thursday or stuff, you guys used to just collect the latest music that we had and just show it to each other and just bop to it at each other's house, you know. Even though we had like an hour or 2 hours just to sit with each other and chill, other kids used to play football and we used to listen to music. And I think that was kind of a big part of my life where I kind of got introduced to hip-hop, and it still stays till today, where some of those songs when I play today, I just get memories of the old days. So that's kind of cool.
Oh, the good old days. And he keep mentioning me, and there were three of us. There was Brendan, and there was my mate Ashley, and then there was me. And that was really true. Like, while other kids were like busy playing cricket or football or something, we just basically took the week to listen to as many songs as we could, and then we would all listen to it at our house or each one of our house. And we used to use WinApp because WinApp had an equalizer, and we used to like play around with the equalizer till we got the sound just right. I mean, that's how crazy about music we were. And it's just good old times, eh? And that actually brings me to my last question I asked him, is that hip-hop culture cannot be disassociated from dancing. And just like the block parties of the heydays, DJ sets the mood of the party and sets the dance floor in any party. So what is it about hip-hop that makes people want to bust a move? And Brendan had a really cool answer for this one. Check it out.
Oh, this one's kind of easy, actually. I think the thing that makes people want to bust a move when they listen to a hip-hop track is that, let's consider like you've come to a party and you listen to hard thumping techno music. You are going to feel out of place because it says something like your heartbeat kind of doesn't match the beats that are currently there around you. So you kind of feel out of place. So, you know, when you come the first time to a place, a person's normal heart rate is kind of like in the A, or like they call it the resting BPM, is kind of in the range of between 70 to 90. I don't know, I might be saying bullshit, but I have a feeling that's what it is. And hip-hop songs, I feel the ones in those days would start off at around 80 to 90. So you sort of slowly start bopping to it because it matched your heartbeat, and you just feel kind of nice when you're listening to that thing. The second thing in that is definitely the bass or the bass line, because, you know, it is the kind of the bass that matches the beats of your heart. So you slowly match up to that, and, you know, your love for the music sort of goes on through the night, and that's what builds it up throughout to the 128, 129 BPM kind of songs at the end of the night. But yeah, I can guarantee you that whenever I play a hip-hop song and I will look at people, it's... I'm going to say that it's first, obviously, if it's a famous person singing the song, then yeah, for sure. But I have played songs that people have no idea so many times, and I still see them like tapping their foot or like, you know, bouncing their head. And yeah, that's kind of easy for me. Like, I just know what song to play at what time when it comes to hip hop. So that's a nice question, actually.
Did you hear that? So hip hop is literally the music of the soul. And I don't think I could have put that in better words. Speaking about words and BPMs and beats and bars, this brings us down to the next pillar of hip-hop, that is MCing, or most commonly known as rapping. Rapping is a form of poetic and verbal acrobatics derived from the ancient African culture and oral tradition. Rapping remove the veil that isolated the wider culture from social conditions of many underserved communities. The rapid-fire wordplay, the spoken truth of the stories that weren't being told, gave rise to a new urban narrative. Rapping then was nothing but the manifestation of the social conditions of the time. The increasing popularity of hip-hop culture throughout the 90s can be likened to the actual social revolution of significant proportions. Traditionally, the oppressed groups are able to use music to convey their plight and circumstances, and in that way, they rebel both overtly and covertly against the oppressive conventionalities within society. Over the years, rapping has taken a different turn, and I will fully concede that some of these turns are highly misogynistic, chauvinistic views against women filled with materialistic appropriations. While this part of rapping may truly never die down due to commercialization of hip-hop music, you just know some kind of things just sell, it would be a miss to paint all the artists as stereotypes. Artists like Logic, who speak about race, gender equality, domestic abuse, mental health, or Mozzie from San Francisco Bay Area, who speaks about growing up in tough neighborhoods and projects, or Talib Kweli, who carried out the tradition of socially conscious hip-hop by addressing issues like police brutality and overrepresentation of African Americans in prison. Hip-hop and rapping has always been the voice of underrepresented marginalized communities. Finally, hip-hop has found its way outside the United States in the past few decades. Today, you can hear South American, African, European, and even Korean hip-hop artists using their lyrics as a medium to communicate to the masses. Even in India, we have up-and-coming artists who are speaking against fighting oppression or the devastating effects of colonialism and the struggles against racism. Therefore, the underlying themes of hip-hop are relevant to any society, so it is only natural that this genre would spread across the globe. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, we conclude on the role of music, specifically hip-hop, on culture. And on to the next role of music in choice architecture and behavioral economics. So over here, I'm going to talk about a couple of experiments. And these experiments will highlight the role music had to play in the overall choice architecture. In the first experiment, 120 Scottish college students were assigned to one of four rooms in a lab. Each of the four rooms featured one of three types of music: American, which is the Beach Boys; Chinese, the Peking Brothers; and Indian, Suniti Chauhan, on a continuous loop. The fourth room had no music. Participants were given a menu featuring 30 entrees representative of the cuisine of China, India, and the United States, which were the hamburger, the dim sum, and chicken tikka masala, respectively. After perusing the menu for a few minutes, the students were asked to recall and list as many of the menu items as they could before choosing one item to hypothetically order. And sure enough, the room's atmospheric music not only affected what menu items the participants ordered, but also which words the participant remembered. People were more likely to select the menu items that corresponded to the music they heard. For example, those who listened to Beach Boys were more likely to order the American fare, such as hamburgers or hot dogs. The second experiment looked at how different styles of music could influence the perceived cash value of an item. Because of the so-called upmarket connotations of classical music, the researchers expected that classical music would lead people to pay more for social identity products affiliated with sophistication and a high roller lifestyle, like cologne or gold-studded earrings. They hypothesized that the country music, in contrast, would lead participants to pay more for utilitarian products, maybe like toothpaste, like ballpoint pens, pencils, tissues. And once again, groups of 180 college students were used for this experiment. So these college students heard either classical music or country music or no music while viewing 20 slides with 10 social identity products and 10 utilitarian products. At each slide, participants wrote down the top price they would be willing to pay for each of these 20 products. Those listening to country music were prepared to pay more for utilitarian products than the participants in the other two groups. While listening to classical music, they were willing to pay more for social identity products than other participants. In both cases, the music was unconsciously affecting people's decision-making process. Music in this case was acting as a trigger. It jogged the memory of the listeners and their mind races to find any related memories. In fact, the behavioral effect that was underlining their decision is actually called priming. So, music in this case was affecting the way the students perceive the object in front of them and the scenario and the overall choice architecture. So what is priming? In psychology, priming is a technique in which the introduction of one stimulus influences how people respond to a subsequent stimulus. Priming works by activating an association or a representation in the memory just before another stimulus or task is introduced. This phenomena occurs without our conscious awareness, and yet it can have a major impact on numerous aspects in our daily lives. My only gripe with these experiments is that they were conducted in controlled environments, in laboratory-like settings, essentially. And additionally, we know that we behave differently when we are being watched. Therefore, it is possible that the knowledge of being participants in experiment would have pre-primed the suspects to behave in a certain way. Therefore, the environments, audience demographic, culture, context all play a crucial role in building choice architectures. Isolating and testing music will not lead to substantial result. And if the aforementioned factors are not considered, then it's really not going to work. Therefore, one thing is for certain, that music alone cannot influence the decision-making paradigm. Rather, a combination of variables are necessary for them to work in the real world. So with that complete, and I'd like to move on to a final topic of discussion, that is the role of music in advertising. And this one's really easy. It's jingles, basically. And one of the most notable singles out there is actually... I'm going to let my co-host Ritika sing this for us. She's a much better singer. Over to you.
Smelly cat, what a treat for you. Smelly cat, it's not your fault.
Thank you so much, Smelly Cat, everyone. It's so iconic that every time you hear it, you're automatically going back to that episode. Here's another one for our Indian audience, which I personally believe has stood the test of time.
Washing powder in their mouth, washing powder in their mouth. Do the sisa fedi, mere master hai. Rangeen kapda bhi khil khil jaye. Sabki pasand nirma.
Tell me you remember that one, because every time I hear it, it takes me back to my school days where this would be blaring on the radio early in the morning. So thank you, Ritika, for that wonderful trip down memory lane. So in fact, the jingle plays a vital role in generating recall and recognition for an advertisement. In this day and age of increasing competition amongst brands aching for customers' attention, marketers are leaving no stone unturned when it comes to creating an impression about their brands in the customer's mind. And being that the musical tunes and jingles are the most memorable and catchy elements of any advertisement, this makes a lot of sense. An effective jingle can create a unique position for the brand in the customer's mind. In fact, studies have found that the income and age group of customers directly relates to the effectiveness of jingles in creating sales. The same study also concluded that targeting lower age group has a higher chance of enhancing sales through jingles. Another great example of music and its role in advertising that's worth discussing is Coke Studio. What started out as a marketing initiative to attract the youth in emerging countries is now a major TV program. From its humble beginnings in Brazil, the basic recipe of Coke Studio hasn't changed all that much. For the unbeknownst, Coke Studio is an initiative by the world's largest beverage company to bring together local up-and-coming musical talents of different genres together into a mellifluous melange of raw, unplugged, authentic, auditory masterpieces. I mean, the show was retrofitted for the Asian market, particularly the Pakistani and the Indian market. The show was an instant hit, engaging 9 out of 10 TV-owning Pakistanis. Cook Studio episodes are unique and captivating in that it brings musicians from all over these regions, international artists too, to create live studio sessions with musicians jamming to compositions exclusively made for this series. When Coca-Cola began this initiative in India, they were really up against Pepsi, which had built an identity that tied considerably into the world of cricket. And this was bad news for Coca-Cola, since the Indian consumers only held three things sacred: cricket, Bollywood, and music. And by partnering up with MTV, Coke was able to target the right audience mix and find a way to bring Bollywood and music together to create a huge brand strategy for itself. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, we have concluded this episode. And before I close, I'd like to call upon the definition of music I quoted in the beginning of this episode, that music is a deep, mysterious paradox. And understanding its role in our daily life is crucial for understanding its applications in the real world. Music, therefore, is the language of our souls, and hip-hop has proven this to us. It is designed to invigorate, enthrall, and excite our minds. As our civilization has grown, the use of music and the type of music in our life has also changed, but its influence on our brain has not. So thank you everyone for being here. A lot of research went into this particular episode, and I enjoyed every bit of it, and I hope you liked it too. So thank you for listening. This is Arjun signing off. Until next time, stay strong, be courageous, and be human, everybody.